Audio for the Retro Computing Roundtable is hosted by CyberEars. When you need a rock-solid platform to host and distribute your podcast or other audio media, head over to CyberEars.com. Fast, reliable hosting with unlimited bandwidth. CyberEars is your audio on your terms.
It's August 2nd, 2015, and welcome to episode 106 of the Retro Computing Roundtable.
Well, it seems the Emerald City is far behind me now, and my world has changed back from black to white. But no matter where I go, there's just one thing I'd like to know.
The RCR is a podcast about retro computer news, nostalgia, collecting, basically people who take old junk, stick it in a spare bedroom, and do things with it, I guess. Some people have a way with words and others don't have way. I'm Earl Evans, your host from the Left Coast, and with me today is a lot of our normal ensemble and also one of our co-hosts who doesn't join us very often, but we wish he would. Hello, Ken Gagne.
What? Who? Me? Hello.
It's good to hear your voice. And I heard some of your voice while I was eavesdropping on the live streams from Kansas Fest, where I understand you guys had just a wonderful get-out-of-town time.
Yeah, we're sorry you couldn't be there with us, Earl.
I'm sorry, too. I really loved the time I went to Kansas Fest, saving pennies in my piggy bank for the time that I can do it again.
You were also busy taking old junk into spare bedrooms and doing things to it.
Yes, I was. As creepy as that sounds, indeed. Another one who went to Kansas Fest would be Carrington. Hello, Carrington.
It would be Carrington. Hello.
Mr. CV.
CWV, I'll have you know.
How are you doing today, sir?
I'm fantastic. What a surprise.
Good.
What a shock.
It sounds like you're amped up to your normal level of energy, which, as we all know for Carrington, is 11.
I go to 11, naturally caffeinated.
And last but not least, not ever least, my buddy Paul Hagstrom, who also went to Kansas Fest. Who did we leave out? How are you doing, Paul?
I'm doing pretty well. I just got back quite recently from the trip that started with Kansas Fest. So, and listening to all the podcasts around, I'm sensing that what everyone needs to hear is a lot more about Kansas Fest.
Yeah, perhaps not. I have to say, it's always a joy when I can tune into an RCR and get to hear some new stuff. You know, handful of times that I'm not on the show, it's fun to listen to the show. And this was really a blast, listening to the special episode that you guys did from K-Fest. Really well done. I think it sets a record for the number of people on the Retro Computing Roundtable. But
I think it definitely sets a record for the number of other podcasts represented, like the number of different things. Yeah, so that was super fun. And the variety of podcasts represented. So I really like that.
It was just a really fun show, and if people haven't tuned in to number 105, you should do so. Doesn't matter if you're an Apple aficionado or not.
It does not matter.
It doesn't matter.
It matters to me.
I'm sorry, Carrington, it doesn't matter. So, but anyway, onward we go for today's podcast, and the host always has to come up with a topic. So I sat and thought about this for at least 30 microseconds and then came up with a creative topic. If we had a time machine, we could jump into our TARDIS and go back to the 70s and 80s when we started with all this madness. What is it that we would try to do different or do better with respect to our lives and computers? For instance, what thing do you wish you'd done back then? And now that we have retro computing and we're reliving the 70s and the 80s, kind of a lifelong midlife crisis, what can you actually make that right and do that thing that you wanted to do back then? Since I'm the host, I'll go first. I really wish back then that I had created a interpreter or a compiler. I love to use languages. I love to program in a variety of languages. I like to, I was a computer polyglot then and now, but I never actually created a language, and that's been a sore spot with me. So it's something that I'm trying to fix right now. Another thing was being more proficient in assembly language. I'd seen it. I could decode a little bit of it, but it was very intimidating to me back then. Not so much now. And especially with the internet, there's a lot more resources. So I'm trying to beef up on my assembly, especially 6502. And so creating a fourth interpreter is something that's doing both things for me. And I'm having a huge amount of fun doing it. So let me go around the table and ask you folks what sort of things you didn't do back in the heyday and that you think maybe you could do now with the retro computing craze. I'll go in the same order. Ken, I'll start with you.
Well, I'm not sure this quite falls into that category, but when I was an undergraduate in college, I started off majoring in computer science, and I did that for 2 years and was terrible at it, earned a lot of credits, but just not very good grades, and realized this wasn't going to make me happy, so I switched to communications, became a writer. And my concentration in computer science served me well because I ended up being an editor at Computer World magazine, and I now teach courses in online publishing and WordPress. But I wish that I had gotten a minor in computer science, that I actually had that on my degree and on my resume, so that when people look at my profile and they see, oh, he's a communications major, what exactly does that mean? If it said with a minor in computer science, they're like, oh, he's a geek who knows how to talk. That we understand that. And I wish I had some official line item to solidify this marriage of careers that I've made for myself.
Interesting. So do you think that's applicable to your career today? Or do you think that your long and illustrious resume at this point pretty much proves that you're a geek who knows how to talk?
I think I'm still trying to prove that every day. I don't know that a minor would help me so much now. It certainly would have 10 years ago. I can't go get just a minor now. Probably like maybe some certificate program somewhere. But you make a good point that since I'm already teaching this stuff, it doesn't necessarily seem sensible to go get a degree in it. That seems a little backwards. But, you know, it still would have been nice 10 years ago.
Gotcha. Interesting. Understood. Well, what about you, Carrington?
I have no regrets.
Okay. That's the way to live, man.
Actually, I was thinking that I don't know how you're writing a fourth compiler when you never wrote the first one. One of us had to say it. One of us had to say it. It was me.
Thank you, Carrington.
just to get that out there. Okay, now we can all relax. It was building up. So, regrets, I've had a few, as they say. I think the two things that came to mind, one, like yours, is programming related. By the time I got into more serious coding, I'd moved on from the Apple II, and I was using things with a full IDE in a way that really I didn't think, or maybe I don't think was even available for the Apple II. So I got into Mac coding and then Unix stuff, and I got used to the big screens and the multi-windows and all of that, and so I never really did much for the Apple II other than some AppleSoft Basic stuff, some assembly things, but just like little bits and bobs, and I never really completed something more significant as a game, and so that's a bit of a regret. And now that there are such great coding tools, I'm really feeling the itch to do something sort of bigger, like a bigger game or like an Ultima style thing, or just something that I could try to tackle. So yes, it is a regret, and yes, maybe now I could do something about it. The other couple of things that came to mind are, as a kid, I loved Apple II games. And I frequently cheated at them. I would either go in and edit them to give myself better characters, or I would look up things. And I loved text adventures and big adventure games. And I frequently would cheat my way past puzzles or look up things. And it really does, you know, you're only cheating yourself. And it's true. And I subsequently stopped doing that and have a much better experience with games now that I just, you know, let them be hard. So that is something I have corrected, because I have gone back for lots of years now and replayed, and sometimes played for the first time, old hard games from the vintage era, and I don't cheat on them anymore, even though it would be easier than ever. And so I actually, in a lot of ways, enjoy the adventure games now more than I did back in the day. So that's something that I have actually corrected. So those are the kind of the two things that really jumped out at me. The other big one was I always kind of had a vague idea that I would make my own computer, do the Woz thing, do the Quinn Dunkey thing. I probably won't because it looks like a lot of work, but that's the one thing that sort of still stands out as something that was kind of vaguely a goal slash dream and kind of vaguely sits with me doing nothing about it. So that's the one which I won't do anything about, I would bet. So those are my three responses.
Gotcha. And also you reminded me of another life goal, which is to beat Zork 1, because I've never done it and I really would like to do that someday. It takes a whole lot of paper, a whole lot of maps, and if you want to do it without the cheats like you're talking mm-hmm. about, it's not trivial. So Paul, what about you? I think definitely if the goal was to collect every computer that you could, you're making some headway on that particular one.
That's collect is one word for it. Yes. This is a hard, question. I sort of feel like I did a lot of what I wanted to do, but I kind of wished I had been doing it just slightly earlier. You know, I sort of feel like, you know, I got good at programming just as all the programs that I could think of were written. And so, yeah, I mean, I think the sort of corrective measure that I'm taking now of kind of exploring things beyond what I owned, you know, like I looking at the trying out the other computers and trying to fix things. That I was not a hardware person in any way when the day was present. So, in fact, I think the one hardware thing I did do with my Apple II disk drive when I was a child is I broke off the write protect detector so that I wouldn't have to keep notching the disks. That was
ooh, he lives dangerously.
Not my finest hour. As it turns out, so that worked out well because I also rarely bought games. But as it turns out, there are plenty of copy protections that rely on the thing being write protected and they wouldn't have worked. But I didn't know. So, yeah, I don't know. I think I can't really go back. I can't correct for not having started earlier. But
you have a time machine. So now you can.
Yes.
Earl's giving us time machines. My Doctor Who cosplay is going to be amazing.
Well, okay. Those are some good responses. And, you know, right after the podcast, I guess I have to go back and load up my Zork 1 disc again. Thanks a lot, Carrington.
You're welcome.
Speaking of suggestions that either cost me time or money, let me tell you about some listener feedback. This first one definitely might cost me some money. Thanks to Richard for sending a link from Hackaday. The article that he sent us discusses 6502 and 65816, its 16/32-bit counterpart development boards that you can buy from Western Design Center. That company is the keeper of the 6502 legacy, and for people who think that 6502 is dead, far from it, my friends. The 6502 and its derivative chips have remained in place and being sold for a very long time. And actually, today in embedded applications, I would say is more what Chuck Peddle originally envisioned for the 6502 when he built it. It wasn't so much built to be a computer chip as an embedded processor. So I guess they're keeping that legacy alive, too. And it's one more way to spend my money on these development boards. They look really cool. If you don't want to homebrew, say, your own 6502 or 65816 single board computer, these might just be for you. They're a little on the pricey side. The ones that are, I guess, of the 65XX chips, there are ones that are more the traditional CPU that we're used to, and also ones that are more microcontroller-oriented, more architected like the microcontrollers that we see today. Those development boards are a little cheaper at around the $100 point. If you want the full-blown chip, that's around the $200 price point. A bit high compared to other boards you can play with, like the Arduino boards and that sort of thing, or even some other single board computer kits that you can buy. But hey, it's a 6502, and it's from the people who make the 6502. So we will have a link to this up in the show notes. And thanks again, Richard. Also, thanks to multiple listeners for sending us articles related to the Amiga, as it just celebrated its 30th birthday, and they had the 30th birthday celebration, I believe, at the Computer History Museum, right? And these articles that folks sent us include a multi-year, multi-part saga on Ars Technica. There was actually a set of articles, 8 parts in all, written on Ars, and very fascinating. Also, there's a great article on The Guardian UK, and there's another one on retrocomputingnews.com, ages ago interview with Jay Miner, who was the father of the Amiga and had previously done the design for the Atari 400 and 800. So check out those links. Lots of reading there for you. Again, those will be in the show notes. Speaking of links, this seems to have this article really made the rounds, Carrington, about two bored 1970s housewives. What do you have to say about that?
I don't like the title. That's my first response. It's like, come on, Fast Company. This is a really good article, though. Like, holy moly, I dug this. So it is about, oh my goodness, now I forget their names. There was Lori Harp and Carol Ellie, Eli, something like that. Sorry. Anyway, they made a computer that I think we have briefly mentioned before ages ago on the RCR, but didn't really stick with me. It is like basically an S100 type computer. I'm not even remotely aware of this thing, and it has a fascinating background from two fascinating women. It's neat. It comes in green and orange. Well, it came in green and orange, and so that really sets it apart from a lot of the S100 stuff. But when you look at it, it kind of looks like, yes, here's an S100 computer. But it's by a pair of ladies. It precedes that whole, you know, Cambrian explosion of PC clones that basically killed it and so many other computers. But it's neat, with a neat history and great coloring. And it's a cool article because it sort of dives into this background. So I think it's fabulous. I think it's super cool. I never had one, never used one. Like, I think of that era as, you know, Altair 8800 and other kind of, even though I did have an S100 for a while. But, yeah, I dig it. This is a really good article with tons of info that I was previously unaware of. So it makes for a fantastic read. So if you're interested in sort of super early days of home computing, then the Vector one has a fascinating background, and it came in green and orange. So for that alone, it's worth looking at the pictures.
That is really cool. I didn't know about the green and orange thing. I'd heard about Vector Graphic and was just vaguely familiar that it was an S100 system. But what a cool case for back in the day. You know, everything was boring beige, or, well, I guess that there were a couple that had wood siding or something like that back when that was in fashion.
But those ones you would normally, because people were making their own case, right? So this is computer, yeah, with a case itself is a neat thing. What's really cool is they had this word processor. So they combined this some sort of POM board or something that was inside the computer, and also some software you could get. They gave you a full word processor, not WYSIWYG like the way you think of a modern word processor, but more in the terms of old actual word processors. Way back many, many years ago, my family had a big printing company, did coupons and that sort of thing. And we went, like, we did paste up. And so eventually that moved in the, I guess, late 70s to the predecessors for word processors. And so you would type in little symbols, and you'd have the words and then symbols beside it. Sort of all the stuff that's invisible in a word processor, but would be visible. So here are all your control characters. And this computer was around that time, but was doing, full invisible characters, just hit control keys and you've got a word processor. So it really predates a lot of stuff that was happening. So that alone, I think, is super exciting. And it's kind of too bad nothing came of it, because maybe if the vector graphics had hung around in a bit longer, I don't know how it could have against the juggernaut of PC clones, but if it had, or if it spun off the software or something, that could have been maybe a major player in the word processing era, because they really did predate a lot of things. So it was cool to read about that and look at pictures, which are not in this article, but if you just Google the Vector One, there's tons of things on the net talking about it. So I went down a real rabbit hole this week reading all about it and learning lots of stuff. It's fascinating background.
Awesome. Very cool. Well, obviously we'll have a link to that up in the show notes, will we not?
And yeah, and there, somebody else put in the show notes a link to one of these Vector Ones that's currently on eBay. So I don't know who Paul, did you put that in? Who found this?
I did.
Nice. Yes. Well done you. So for $1,200 and something, it's expensive. It's the orange one. So you can pick yourself up in a good condition,
cool looking,
powered on, supposedly working version of one of these.
Wow.
Are you going to buy it?
No.
I'm not going to buy that.
No.
Very expensive.
But if I had a lot of money, I probably would.
I think even if I didn't...
Look at this baby.
I liked having the Altair as a kid, but it was the movement into the TRS-80 Model 1 and then the Apple II were the 1-2 punch of me getting what I considered a real computer. And I mean, it's, oh my gosh, you'll send your email to me. I'm sorry to be so dismissive. But the S100 era and the stuff that sort of predated that, hey, we're a fully a computer as the way I envisioned it as a kid, I find really interesting, but I would never want to actually own or use one anymore. I'd like to look at one, but I would never want to actually work on one, to be honest.
Well, you know, there's a little bit of a challenge to it. I've got in the garage a couple of functional, as far as I know, S100 chassis, and they're big, mm-hmm. and the power supplies are gigantic. The things are heavy, and I don't have any cards for them. It was a system from a company called Alpha Micro, and I sent a bunch of the cards actually to a gentleman named Cameron, who does a lot of restoration and runs a really nice website for Alpha Micro, so kind of a little niche thing. But I thought about using those chassis and the motherboards to put together an S100 system, but there's a lot of idiosyncrasies. You could replace the power supply with modern switching supplies, but then, and we've talked about this a lot, are you really keeping the spirit of the original computer?
If you don't use the one that can kill you, is it a real S100?
Right, because I'm telling you, the power supplies in these things can and will kill you if you touch the wrong spot in them.
Release the 80s death.
Yes, very much the power supply Kraken, I would say.
What I like about them is it's from the era of very open power supplies. I think, even if I switch over to the eBay listing, it's got a picture of the inside. And it's always like, hi, feel free to reach into the left half of me, but you better not reach into the right half of me. Like, it's just exposed everything. It's just crazy.
You can if you're tired of living.
Yep.
Yeah, I know what you mean. No shielding whatsoever. Ah, living on the edge.
Atari probably looked back at these things when they were doing the 800 and 400 and go, look, they did this. Why are you making us put 17 inches of shielding on our stuff?
Oh, no kidding, right? Well, that's a story for another day. I'm moving on. I'm going to talk about Retro Challenge. It's over. That's it.
It's dead to you.
So Retro Challenge 2015/07 has ended. And lots of fun was had by all. Not everyone actually crossed the finish line, but some folks did. I went cruising through the entries. One that I found particularly fascinating didn't really have to do with working with retro computers at all. It was Tez's entry. You know, he runs that amazing classiccomputers.org.nz
and great videos. Website. Holy cow, his video is so good.
Oh, yeah. His YouTubes. If you haven't seen his YouTubes, then pause this podcast right now and go watch some YouTube with Tez, because he does some amazing stuff. But he revamped his website so that it would be mobile-friendly. He embraced the newer standards. He did an awful lot of work. And I wanted to see what it looked like on mobile. So I took out my Android tablet, my Windows phone, and I started bringing up the website. I changed the orientation. I, you know, punched around on different pages, and it rendered marvelously. It was a great mobile experience. And I know that could not have been easy to do, but more and more sites are doing it, and it's actually really neat. If you're on the bus or, you know, whatever, you want to cruise somewhere on your mobile A lot more sites are becoming mobile web browser friendly. So yay, Tez. Also, a little shameless plug, I managed to nudge my own way over the finish line. I got a native 4th working on the Commodore 128, and I've Googled and Googled and Googled. I've, you know, bingled. I've looked, done every search incantation that I can think of, and have not found any other native Commodore 128 4th. As far as I know, this is the first one, so I'm very happy waving the flag of success. Okay, so enough about that and enough about me. We should have Ken talk about himself because he went to the Charles Babbage Institute.
It's true. I like to tack on travel at the beginning or end of each year's sojourn to Kansas Fest, and this year that trip included a visit to the University of Minnesota in Minneapolis, Minnesota, and they are the host of the Charles Babbage Institute. They are one of 10 archives, libraries, or institutions around the world that collects JuiceGS, and through that connection, I emailed the head curator, Arvid Nelson, and said, hey, I'm going to be in the area. Would it be okay if I stop by? And he said, sure, come on by. We'll give you the grand tour. And so I stopped by, and they are not an archive of computer software and hardware. So if you're looking for a lot of big iron or Apple IIs, you're not going to find too much, a little bit, but some. Mostly what they collect is literature and documentation from and about the history of computers. Mr. Nelson brought my friend Sabriel and I down to the catacombs, which are these huge limestone caverns that they have dug out and where they keep just towers and towers of information, not all but exclusively for the Charles Babbage Institute, just in general, the University of Minnesota as well. But even the collection specifically for the CBI was extensive, and Mr. Nelson knew it all like the back of his hand. He was able to walk specifically right down to the aisle and shelf that has JuiceGS, pull it out and say, and here's everything that you've been sending us for the last 20 years. I'm like, amazing. So it was a really, really cool opportunity to have an exclusive two-hour tour. It was just the three of us, the curator, my friend, and I. And it was awesome to see how much is being collected. And also, the areas in which his expertise and mine overlapped and the areas in which he didn't. For example, he was able to go on about stuff I'd never heard about, which is amazing. And then I would say, oh, so you must know Jason Scott, right? And he's like, no, who's that? And I'm like, oh, I have some links to send you.
Yes.
Interesting.
So I hope that maybe just through our discussions, more things will come of this. For example, already I uploaded the Charles Babbage Institute photos to the JuiceGS website and social media, and I got an email from Bill Martin saying, oh, man, I wish I'd known you were going. They are one of the few places where you can find the newsletter that was the predecessor, the ancestor to Call Apple. And I'm like, oh, well, just go ahead and email Arvid and ask for a scan. Here's his email address. And Bill's like, oh, wow, that's great. Thanks. And Arvid emailed me and said, I got an email from Bill. This is great. Thanks for the connection. So who knows what else might come of the awareness of this fantastic facility.
Ken, what a remarkable visit. I envy you getting to see this. I got to ask, I'm looking at the picture right now of one of the aisles here. Is it really as impressive as it looks in this picture? Because this is, it's almost like the Borg ship of computer publications.
It's like that, and it's also like trying to find the Ark of the Covenant. It's just somewhere in that warehouse, and I have no idea where. But
nice.
Yeah, it really is that impressive. I mean, maybe when you first glance at it, you're just like, oh, I'm in a tall room. But then when you think about every inch of every shelf, left to right, bottom to top, is filled with books and literature, and you realize how many miles and pages of documentation must be in this catacomb. Now, the photos I'm showing you there are not exclusively for the Charles Babbage Institute, but the photo of Arvid holding the JuiceGS collection, that is the Charles Babbage Institute. You can see that the ceiling there is only about 10 feet as opposed to 50, but it's still an impressive collection and obviously very well organized.
Nice. Very nice. Thank you for sharing that. Are you actually going to cover that in one of the episodes of JuiceGS, do you think? Or
actually, I've been to other organizations with the intention of covering it for JuiceGS. For example, I went to the International Center for the History of Electronic Gaming, which is part of the Strong Museum. I went there a couple of years ago and interviewed John Paul Dyson for some JuiceGS article that may appear someday. And there probably could be an angle for Juice GS for the Charles Babbage Institute, but that visit was exclusively just a personal and professional visit, just seeing what's out there and making friends and networking. I was on vacation and didn't feel like taking notes or shoving a microphone in Mr. Nelson's face, so it was just, let's walk around and see what you got. Oh, that is worth mentioning, though. He introduced me to one of his colleagues, Mr. Thomas J. Misa, and he has written a book, if I can remember the name of it, called Digital State. It's all about the history of computers in Minnesota, specifically.
Wow, that seems like a niche topic.
Yeah, really. And it's only a book you'd probably find in Minnesota, which is why I'd never heard of it before. But I was able to get a copy of it signed by the author. Obviously, Minnesota has a long history with educational software like Oregon Trail, since that is the home of MECC or MEC. And so that's covered in this book. And that's actually how it came up. I said to Mr. Nelson, since you guys are in Minnesota, you must know everything about MEC. And he's like, actually, I don't, but let me go get my friend Thomas over here. And he came out and gave me this book. And I'm like, oh, wow, cool.
Very cool.
Yeah. So there, you know, people think that the book on so-and-so subject has already been written. Like, oh, Steve Weirich wrote the book on the Apple II. No sense in anybody else doing it. Or, oh, Fire in the Valley. We have already covered Silicon Valley. That doesn't need to be done anymore. But there's always a unique angle if you look for it. Like, the story of Minnesota's computing industry. That's the subtitle of this book. I mean, who would have thought of that except somebody who lives at that intersection like the Charles Babbage Institute does? And so, you know, who knows what other venues or niches are yet to be explored. If you have a story that you think is worth telling, it probably is, because people might not have heard it yet.
It's true. You know, there's one particular niche that I wish somebody would write a book on, the history of electronic medical records. Because I know that this has been going on since the 70s, and I spent a lot of years of my own professional career in the middle of it. And I think that would actually be a fascinating read, because when I was up at the Living Computer Museum, they had some Xerox equipment that apparently had been a really early instance of electronic medical records and was shared by numerous medical practitioners who, you know, use this gigantic computer to store their records. I wasn't even vaguely aware that that kind of thing had been going on that early. So you're right. I mean, there's a million niches and they're probably all worth telling. And so we all need to get writing, don't we?
Well, get to it, Earl. Get to
all
it.
All right, then. All right. Well, I have another book to write, and I better do that one first, because I already promised that one.
Yeah, didn't you say you were going to interview me, and that was like 2 years ago? Did I fall off your radar? Did my invitation get lost in
the
mail?
I did your interview for you. I said all the things you'd want to say. I did an impersonation. I was bang on. Earl never knew.
Oh, great.
Yeah.
Thanks.
I mean, you should hear Carrington's Ken impersonation.
I do a great Ken.
He's doing it right now.
I am alone on this podcast. Doing my Ken, Earl, and Paul.
Well, speaking of Paul,
let's talk about Paul. I got things
yes.
to say.
He's not here, is he? We can talk about him.
The PIDP8, boy, that looks like an exciting kit. I think you bought one, didn't you?
I did, yeah. And Michael also did, but he had actually put the thing in the show notes, and then I stole it from him because he's not here. But both of us have received our PIDP8 kits. At least I believe both of us have. I have, anyway. I think I saw a picture of his, in fact. So I have not done anything with it except open it up and take a picture and marvel at the prettiness of it. But it's a project for soon, I think. We've mentioned this, you know, this was on some prior episode, but it's a PDP-8i emulator, basically, that you mount a Raspberry Pi on. There's a circuit board. You have to do a little assembly, and you put the switches together and mount the Raspberry Pi, and it's got a really nice wooden case and a gorgeous front panel. And when it's done, you have a little PDP-8. I think it runs SIMH in the background so that it, you know, it'll run all the lights on the front, and it'll be just like having a working front panel of a PDP-8i. So looking forward to having that built. There was So there was this first batch that I was, that Michael and I were in that went out this July, this past month. And a second batch is planned to go out in October. So if you are interested in getting one of these and did not get in the first run, I think it is still possible. So we'll have a link in the show notes to where you can find the information and beautiful pictures of what mine should look like when it's done. But I'm excited to try this. I don't know a thing about the PDP-8, you know, actually from a functional standpoint. I don't know how to make it do anything, but there's some software and stuff on the site. And there's a forum too, actually, so you can sort of see, you know, whether people, to what extent people are having trouble assembling these things and what they do with them afterwards. And I opened it and was quite surprised actually at how many topics are already there. So, it seems like a relatively active community right now.
Well, so you've actually got one in your hot little hands right now. So I know you haven't put it together yet, but how does it look?
Oh, it looks great. It looks like the pictures, but except that right now it's just a front panel and a box and a bunch of parts. but it's a nice sort of two-tone brown digital front. All the switches are there. You have to paint them yourself.
I was going to say, you got to paint the switches, right? So
yeah,
that's going to be a little bit of a chore. What colors are you going to go with? Have you decided that yet? Because it looked like there were a couple of different choices of how you could do it.
Well, no, I haven't actually. I haven't thought about that much. There was a little bit of discussion on the maybe it was an email to the people who bought them. I'm not sure, but with a couple of different options, you can get a sort of a paint that's close enough, or you can have the paint mixed yourself to have it be exact. And I think I'll probably go with close enough. But the ones in the pictures are sort of brown, and maybe it's just brown and white, actually. I'll probably go with the recommendation from the pictures, just because I don't have any opinion.
Gotcha. So. Well, it'd be neat to see when you and Michael get yours built. That's going to be fun. You guys could report back.
Maybe we can play, you know, chess over paper tape.
Very nice. All right. So, Carrington, Apple IIgs Bounty, does that mean that there's a price on its head?
Yes, there is. I'm offering. No. It's a bounty, like a bountiful thing. Got a bunch of links. For a guy who is very much an 8-bit Apple user, I owned a 2GS back in the day. I have a 2GS right now. Listen. That was me kicking it. I don't know if you can hear it, but under my table on the floor, I nudged it away. There is a portable Apple IIgs. I just never was into the operating system. I, again, send your hate mail to me, but always sort of saw the 2GS as not a good enough Macintosh because I switched over. So it's so terrible. Oh, so terrible. It's terrible. My thinking is terrible. I have subsequently come around a bit to start to look at the 2GS as instead a very powerful version of the Apple II, and I don't use it with GSOS. And by not doing that, I actually like it a lot better. That said, if you have been holding off installing system 601 because you heard it was buggy, well, good news. 22 years and some odd months later, it's been upgraded to system 602 to squash a bunch of bugs. Now, obviously, not updated by Apple. Silly us expecting that to happen. No, it was Apple IIgs users have come together and actually, almost like as a proof of concept, patched a bunch of bugs and released an updated system. How freaking cool is this? So
that's just amazing.
I know, it's bonkers. It's totally bonkers. So it's been making the rounds and making the news, and I just think it's amazing. So even as somebody who doesn't really use it, I think it's fantastic. And I did grab it. I am going to play with it because, like, come on, how cool is that? So a whole bunch of bugs fixed in HFS, and it now comes with the Ethernet drivers, I think, built in, and a bunch of DOS file system translators fixed, and text edit bugs, and like just a whole bunch of bugs fixed all the way through it. There's still bugs to go, they say, and so let's, you know, come together and make a 603 and maybe not take 22 years to do it. But it's a fantastic achievement. So the beginning of our 2GS bounty is we will have links to where you can grab yourself a copy of 602 over at the callapple.org site. In addition to that, though, there is the hard disk of emulator, no, the floppy emulator, you know, floppy emu, floppy emu, I don't know, whichever that, I don't know how to pronounce it, but it's super cool. But if you follow that, then that's not only works with the stuff, but there you over at the big MesoWire site, you can download the image with everything all packed together. So that's super, super cool, because if you're a floppy emu user, then you're not being left out. In addition, we add to our bounty there. Burger Becky was at Kansas Fest, bringing up Kansas Fest again. And she was amazing. It was I had lunch with Burger Becky. I got to sit at a table headquartered to her, and I was like, this is so cool. And gave a keynote, and it was amazing and inspiring, and it was wonderful to meet her, and has, you know, such an incredible background in development for games back from the Apple II day and on to today. Well, if you would like to code like Burger Becky, and of course, who wouldn't, then we have a trio of links for you. The first is, I guess maybe a bit of a fire was lit under her because of Kansas Fest, and she has put together and released the complete archives of Space Ace for the Apple IIgs. So this is basically all of Space Ace if you wanted to compile and make your own copy of it. So you can head over to her GitHub little section of the world, old school, S-K-U-U-L, and this has like everything. It's all the bits. The intellectual property, as she even says, is, you know, not owned by her. It's Don Bluth and Digital Leisure. But this is a complete copy of Space Ace. So if you wanted Space Ace for the 2GS, for instance, you can go grab this, compile it. It does compile, and you have a complete running copy of it. And it's now been compiled. So there's the different people on the website, or on the internet, on the web, I've heard of the web, have compiled it and have their own blog posts going, oh my gosh, I now have Space Ace. But you don't just have the game, you've got all the code. You can look through it, you can make changes, you can do things. You have a, you know, ready to go collection of this is how Space Ace was done. So that's super cool. In addition to that, though, as if that wasn't enough, she's upgraded BurgerLib. So BurgerLib is the low level library that she's been using for like ever and ever and ever. So if you wanted to do game development for old school stuff, BurgerLib is what Becky used and still continues to use, and it builds and it compiles and it runs on, you know, not just Mac OS X, but original Mac OS and MS-DOS and Xbox 360 and PS4 and PS3 and like Visual Studio stuff and the Nintendo Wii and like a whole bunch of things, old and new. Unfortunately, 2GS, which was part of it for ages, has been recently depreciated, but I'm hoping that it's going to slip back in after all this exciting Apple II stuff that she's been doing. So that's super cool. So if you want to do game development and you want to do it like Burger Becky, then you'd want to grab that. And if you want to start off as she would start off a new project, she's also has Kitchen Sink. So Kitchen Sink is the whole build environment she uses. And it works in Xcode, but also works in Wacom and works in Visual Studio. So this is how, if you were Burger Becky and you were sitting down to make a whole brand new game, this is what you would use, and she makes it totally available. Crazy awesome stuff. So very exciting times in the Apple II world, particularly when it comes to coding. And I do think a lot of this has sort of come out of her coming to Kansas Fest and seeing the excitement that the community still has for development and for what she's done now and what she's done in the past and all of that. So super, super exciting stuff, particularly the Space Ace code, which I grabbed and is very exciting. So that's it. That is our 2GS bounty. A whole bunch of links will be in the show notes. So check it out and grab stuff and make yourself some games.
And as you said earlier, if you wanted to make a game, or back in the day you wish that you had, there are so many new development tools, development libraries, helps, information, that kind of thing that are coming out, that it really does lower the bar for being able to do something exciting. This is great stuff. I can't say enough good about people who release this stuff, and especially some of these things that are coming from the past, and that, you know, they get stuck out there in the community where people can pick them up and learn from them and use them. Neat. Neat stuff. Thank you for that report, Carrington.
Hey, have we talked about Bard's Tale on this podcast?
No, we have not. Never.
I don't think we have. Yeah.
Because that might be worth mentioning in the context of why Burger Becky has been so contributive and active in the Apple II community lately, which is that Brian Fargo, that one of the founders of Interplay and who worked on, I think actually founded the Bard's Tale series, recently went on Kickstarter to crowdfund Bard's Tale 4, a brand new game in the franchise, and one of the Kickstarter rewards or stretch goals that he was aiming for was to release the Apple II GS versions of Bard's Tale 1, 2, and 3 in an emulator that would run on Mac and PC. And Berger Becky said, well, I have the source code. Why don't I just recompile it to run natively on Mac and PCs instead of in an emulator? And Brian Fargo said that'd be amazing. So her company, Old School, is working on that. Anybody who backed the Bard's Tale 4 project at, I think, $20 or higher will get those rewritten games. And so in the course of signing that contract with Brian Fargo of In Exile Entertainment, she booted up her Apple II for the first time in ages and found all this old source code. And she's like, well, as long as I'm looking for the Bard's Tale source code, what else might I find? And she found Space Ace and all this other stuff. So cool.
Wow. Well, that's some great backstory on that, too. Ken, while you have the floor, you have an article here about Lead Light Gamma, and I don't know what that is.
Yeah, so that's another developer who found some notes from an old game, and I can't believe I missed this when it happened back in April, but I was researching a brief news blurb for Juice GS back in June. It's Mr. Wade Clark, who is the developer of numerous text adventures, and he recently released some games that he wrote 25 years ago, and what was extraordinary about that was that he kept his handwritten notes on which he plotted out the maps and the levels and the rooms in these text adventures back when he was, I don't know, 16, 20 years old or something, because there weren't really a lot of drafting and sketching tools on computers 25 years ago, so he did it in hard copy. But the game that really caught my attention is one that originally just came out 5 years ago. That is Lead Light. It's a game that he developed for the Apple II in the Eamon Adventure System, and he entered it into the annual Interactive Fiction Award. I think it won an award called the Golden Banana for the most diverse range of scores. People either loved it or hated it. But I enjoyed it, and it made the cover of the very first ever issue of Juice GS to have a color cover. That was his game on that issue back in 2011, I believe. No, 2012, 2011, one of those. Anyway, so this game is one that he has been working on porting to Inform, which he has written about in JuiceGS, and that finally came out in this past April. It's called Lead Light Gamma. It has a bunch of new features, including a soundtrack of sorts, an auto mapper, etc., and it runs natively on Mac, PC, and I think maybe kind of sort of Linux, but to distinguish between the Apple II version and this new native version, he calls the new one Lead Light Gamma, but feature-wise and content, well, not feature-wise, but content-wise, it's the same as Lead Light. So if you download the latest version of Lead Light and the latest version of Lead Light Gamma, you're playing the same game, it's just the environment and the utilities available to you will be different. It's not like different puzzles or different text. All the descriptions are the same, which I think is great to have that parity. But it's available as a commercial product for, I think, $5 on itch.io, which is a platform a little bit like Steam or Desura, where people can sell their own games. And I think it's really cool that he did this. So I interviewed him, not for JuiceGS, because I've already interviewed him for that, and the decision was made to give him some love through other outlets. So I have a podcast of my own where I interview indie game developers, and I spoke with Wade for about a half an hour about what is it like to port an Apple II game, a text adventure especially, to Mac and PC, and why would anybody even write an Apple II or a text adventure game in the year 2015? So that interview is available on my podcast, IndieSider.net, IndieSider, which is an unfortunate name because it sounds like somebody who's indecisive, IndieSider. But it's available as an audio podcast and on YouTube.
Awesome.
Yeah, and I got to tell you, a let's play of a text adventure, riveting. Watching that on YouTube, I mean, you just can't tear your eyes away.
Yeah, you got to dramatize it. That's the only way to do it.
I got to work on my voice acting skills, that's true.
Very nice. Well, I very much would like to listen to that bit, so I'm going to go do that now. I'll talk to you guys in a while.
All right. It's the Ken Show. Yay.
And, Paul, you get to close us out with an article about, oh, wait, Kansas Fest?
Never heard of it.
Yeah, so there was an article written on Vice.com by Jason Kobler, who, I guess, I didn't actually see him at Kansas Fest, but apparently he was there and talking to people, interviewing people, and wrote up quite a long, very good article about sort of what Kansas Fest is and, you know, the people that are there and why people do it. And every year when this comes up, you know, there's a couple little, you know, paragraph long things to say, look at these weird people. They go and they play with, you know, computers that have been obsolete for, you know, 25, 30 years. But this is actually quite in depth and it's a really nice write up. And it's accompanied by an audio. I'm not sure actually what is the thing. So it's called Motherboard and some subsection of Vice. And so I'm not sure if it's a podcast.
I think it's a podcast. Yeah. I hadn't encountered it before, okay. But they're billing it as it is a podcast. Yeah.
Yeah, it's available on SoundCloud, but
who listens to podcasts?
Right. Honestly, exactly. You can download it through any podcatcher.
But so this is the podcast. The audio that they have is not like these are two separate things. There's a great article. It's a long article, and it's different from the audio. So you have to listen to it and read it, and it's great. It's really quite interesting. So if you are not yet tired of, or maybe, you know, in a couple months when the Kansas Fest has died down on the podcast, you can listen to this. But I mean, I was there and I still thought it was interesting to listen to this. So just to recommend it.
And the photos on this article are great. Obviously, mm-hmm. professional photography and good angles, good lighting. I mean, these are some of the best photos that I've seen of the event. Really nice.
I thought it really captured the article in particular, but you're right. I like them both, the audio and the article. But the article and the photos, they so captured the feeling of Kansas Fest. So looking at them and coming off it fresh, I was like, yeah, this is. I mean, I wouldn't necessarily say I agree with everything in there, but everyone has their own Kansas Fest experience. And I thought that this stuff, and particularly the stuff that Jason's quoted to say in it, really do sort of make this one of the few things that talks about it, not in that whole look at these crazy people and their silly love of useless computers. Like, it's taking a different tack, and I appreciated that. If anything, I wish news was slower sometimes, because it's the kind of thing that would be a lovely way to promote people to come to next Kansas Fest. So it's too bad it's coming out right after this year's Kansas Fest. What I wanted to do is come out when the registration is open for next year's Kansas Fest, because it's been growing. And this is the kind of thing that people would read and go, heck yeah, I want to join in, because I want the event to keep growing. So it's the kind of article I'm going to keep bookmarked and maybe try to get back into the social media circles again, you know, maybe 11 months from now or something, or maybe 10 months from now, because I do think it's the kind of thing somebody would read and think, yeah, I want to go to there. Like, this captures the kind of things that draw me to Kansas Fest every year.
Very nice. Yeah, it's a good article, and I'll have to have a listen to that audio. But before I do that, a word from our sponsor.
We've secretly replaced Carrington with Folgers crystals.
Let's see if he notices.
Univac, the giant electronic brain made only by Remington Rand, takes business statistics from magnetic tape, letters, numbers, and punctuation marks, processing them through its electronic circuits at phenomenal speeds. Univac can compute payrolls electronically, then produce printed checks in a flash, over 8,000 checks an hour with this high-speed printer. Univac leads the field of electronic computing.
Hey, I have to have a gift idea, and I do. This gift really turned me on. Sorry. It's a power button, a green computer power button keychain. Now, you might think, what's so exciting about this? It's just a power button. And at face value, not so much. It is pretty cool looking. But the thing I thought about, I have a NEC RISC chip, I think, keychain that I must have had on my belt for 25 years. And it reminded me how often I take out my keys and I see the keychain, and it's just, you see it more often than you think, because every time you're getting in your car or getting in your house or whatever. And so it's fun to have a nice, cool, geeky kind of keychain. And this one just really seemed like it hit the spot for me. So that's my geek gift recommendation of the week.
So being a green computer power button, does that mean this turns on green computers? So it would work with the one half, one version of the Vector 1. And then we have to get an orange computer. So you're bringing it all together, Earl. I like your style.
I thought you meant green like environmentally friendly.
Also
in
that.
Which case, probably none of our
no
old
vector
computers.
Ones.
Yeah, not a vector one. Your power company will love you if you get one of those old S100s. So now we should go to other ways to spend money, like eBay auctions. Carrington, you're up first.
The Apple Boogie. Now, do you guys know what the Apple Boogie is? Because I did not know about the Apple Boogie, and I'm very excited to now know about the Apple Boogie. So Apple...
This looks like Dance Dance Revolution, except for...
Apple produced their own music. Like, not Apple, Apple, the record label that would sue the Apple, the computer maker, but Apple put out a parody music cassette produced and actually distributed by Apple Computers in 1985. I did not know this. It has parody songs on it, and I did not know this, and I'm very happy to now know it. So, the Apple Boogie is a cassette tape full of parody songs produced and released by actual Apple Computer in 1985. So, I will link to a copy of this tape if you want to get a real one. It's available on eBay. If you just want to hear the songs, and oh yes, believe me, you do, we will also have a link over to a site where you can just download everything in MP3 format. If you want to read about this album, and oh yes, you do, there was a good write-up in thenextweb.com. So this is the stuff I've been reading about today, because I just stumbled on this, and I've been listening to the songs, and holy cow, I don't even know how to describe this stuff, but you really, it's a run, don't walk thing. I had no idea this existed at all. I cannot believe I've been to Kansas Fest all these times and nobody has just been playing this in the hallway. When you can hear songs like Blue Busters, which is, you know, a take on the Ghostbusters, but it's about taking down Big Blue. You know, we're going to, the Blue Busters, that sort of thing. I can't believe this thing existed. Like, this is amazing. It does exist. You can get yourself a copy, or for free, you can download a copy of the songs, and it will be played in the hallways of next year's Kansas Fest. This I can guarantee. As an alternative, if you don't want to buy this cassette, because I think you just need the MP3 songs, I'm also going to have a link to the Outbound laptop. There's one of those on eBay at the moment. It's super expensive. I think they're looking $1,200 for it. So, yikes. But it's a fairly rare thing. And I brought it up because somebody mentioned the Outbound at this year's Kansas Fest. Because I can't say Kansas Fest enough on this podcast, clearly. And because of that, I've been reading about them. I was always aware of the Outbound back in the day. That was the Macintosh portable, but it was a clone portable, and so it came out before the actual Mac portable, and it was something where they made this laptop, but you couldn't distribute actual Apple ROMs, so you would have to, you know, borrow the ROMs from an actual Plus or SE to stick in these, and they would run. They were very famous for quite a unique way to move the mouse. So instead of being the normal trackpad, or in that back in the day, a trackball, they had this thing called an isobar, and the isobar was literally a bar, so you'd put your finger on it and you would roll it up and down to move the mouse up and down, but the bar itself could slide left and right, and so that gave you the full motion on screen. And I don't know any other computer that ever used this thing, so I always remembered the Outbound as that. There was, I've subsequently learned, both an Outbound laptop and an Outbound notebook. The laptop came first, that's this one, and if you look at the eBay auction, they're carefully showing you pictures from the front. And it's a really cool looking device, like with a neat keyboard and that isobar, and it all looks really cool. And if you look at the height of the keyboard, it's really slender. So you see something like this and go, oh my gosh, this came out before the Mac Portable. Look how thin that is. Well, if you were to look from the side, you would then learn that it's because the keyboard is nice and flat, but the actual computer is quite thick. It's something like, I don't know, I think in inches, it's like 8 inches or something thick. Like that's the thick. And 7.5 inches of those lift up. And that's the screen and the motherboard. It has a built-in floppy disk. And all of that raises up and then has a little stand that supports it, because otherwise it would just flip over. So you have a nice slender keyboard and a massive thing you lift up. So it's kind of neat. The subsequent Outbound, the notebook, was different, whereas the smaller screen that lifts up and the relatively thicker bottom, but much thinner than this, because that's the the way the trends were going. So it's a really neat device. So you don't see them pop up nice. And what's nice about this particular one, even though it's $1,200, is it does work. It's shown working. It's very clean. It's complete. It comes with a bit of software. It comes with the external floppy as well. And it comes with a carrying case. And so like, if you did want one of these and you had money to burn, this is a really nice one. One of the nicest ones I've seen. So I recommend it. It's cool. I wouldn't buy it myself, but I am linking to it anyway.
Very neat. Had never even heard of this before.
Oh, you never heard of the Outbounds? Oh, no. They were super cool. I remember back in the day, they were sold in Canada as well.
Huh.
Yeah.
Well, I guess that's why I'm not just an RCR host, I'm also a client.
Yeah, that isobar is the cool thing about them. That's the thing that always stood out for me.
Yeah, innovative.
Yeah.
Huh.
Yeah, I'd kind of like to just try one out. You know, I don't think I want to get an Outbound. Plus, you have to sacrifice a Mac to do it. But
yeah.
But there's lots of dead Macs, right? So it wouldn't. There's got to be a way to come across a dead board that just has decent ROMs, or you know, write them to a prom or something. That can't be that hard. It's got a weird screen, like it's mono, but it's 640 by 400, so in a lot of ways a better resolution than the desktop Macs of the time. But also still a weird resolution, and it's grayscale, and it's super heavy. I think it's 20 pounds or something. But it's a really neat, unique device. So it's one I've never had been able hands-on with, so I would love to play with one.
Well, I hope I get to see one someday. Mm. That looks pretty cool. Ken, are you really auctionless?
Yes, I am. I'm sorry.
We are selling Ken.
No! No.
I'm priceless.
We can't do that. He just came back.
That's right.
But we could sell Paul.
Well, that's just not nice. Although I guess Boston doesn't really need both of us, does it?
Oh, now, hey.
Although, you know, if I'm for sale and Paul buys me, he can pick up locally and save on shipping.
Very excellent. Nice. So, Paul, if I apologize, will you tell us about your auction?
I will happily do that. Actually, I wanted to just say a couple more things about the Apple Boogie tape. There's a relatively famous song among the Apple II community, the Apple II Forever. Now that one did sort of spread wide, and that's from this tape. I think I've listened to all the songs on here, maybe once, but it's very of its time. But I wanted to mention that there's a video that goes with the Ghostbusters, the Blue Busters song. So if you search YouTube, I'll find a link for it. But it's yeah.
Oh, Paul,
anyway,
you make me so happy.
Else to watch.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
I knew the Apple II Forever song. You're right. That's the one that sort of everybody knows. I had no idea there was a whole tape and seven other songs of glory for us to listen to.
Okay. So the auction I found. Well, there's a couple of them. I'm going to link to the nicer one. And this time I'm just have the one. But it's a Science Fair Radio Shack microcomputer trainer. And so if you open the link, it's basically like those little electronics kits that Radio Shack made, or, you know, logic kits where you sort of put things together with little springs and wires and no soldering and, you know, your whatever 10-year-old hands are safe. But this one actually has a... this one is more like those Heathkit things where you have a microcontroller in it, and you sort of, or like a microprocessor in it, and you control it with, there's little push button keys, and there's a hex LED output, and then some individual LEDs, and it looks actually pretty cool. I think it would have been, maybe this is what I would have done, and maybe what I should have done if I take my time machine back and learn how to do this. But it claims to teach you how to do assembly machine language programming, I guess. Does it say assembly? I think it does say assembly.
This is amazing. At first I was like, oh, it's one of these. I like these. These are cool. No, this one is great. Holy moly. Yeah. I've never seen one that had the little hex input keyboard. And this is way beyond the ones I had as a kid.
Yeah.
Great fun.
When this came up, I had the same sort of feeling. It's like, oh yeah, I remember this. You have a little button, and it's maybe a speaker, and you know, you can do circuits. But this, you can actually program this. It has a little bit of RAM. It has has like a music playing game in ROM, and a couple of other things in ROM, and the manuals with it. This particular one. So this particular seller, you might recognize this particular seller if you
as
dig deeply enough. It is a I suppose we don't need to hide it, but it is a one of the things that the seller has is a book. If you look at the listings, Classic Computing Book, Computer History, and Nostalgia Zine Collection. This is David Grealish, in fact.
Oh, David. Hello, David.
So, good to see you. I found the auction prior to noticing who's selling the thing. But it looks great, and actually he's got two of them. One's more beat up than the other.
Oh, yeah, one's more beat up box, really. So you can save yourself a bit if you buy the one with the beat up box.
Yeah, but this looks really cool. Actually, it was a little tempting not to even promote it to the world, but I could not. So I dug around a little bit to try to figure out what processor that is. There out there in the world, there are scans of the manual, and no mention at all. There's no information about what you know this is. There's a manual. It's mostly just programs you can type in. It does have some information about how you can write your own, and that the chip on the trainer has a little bit of RAM and the processor itself, but as far as I know right now, they don't ever say what actual RAM processor it is. So
David also has a Tandy Model 102 for just $60. David, I'm going to buy all your auctions. Oh, David doesn't ship to Canada. David, I just checked to see if he's on Skype so I could get him into this call. What the heck, dude? May not ship to Canada. David. Okay.
I'm sorry. I think there's something in the bylaws about harassing the founder.
Nope. Yeah, it says you should harass the founder. David wrote the bylaws. He would want us to harass him. No, I like everything he has for sale, and I want to buy it all.
So that's my one pick.
One pick?
Awesome.
Just one this time.
Yeah, I mean, that's what took me off guard.
Doing multiples now. Like, what's up?
But Earl hasn't done his.
Yeah, what do you got,
that's
Earl?
That's true. And I really like mine. It's a Teletype Model 26. So these are old, like from the 40s. And there's actually a video that the seller put up of this thing doing something. He turns it on and a little motor, and those teletypes goes chug, 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 chug. He doesn't show it actually typing anything, though, which makes me a little suspicious. I don't know if that part works. I should read through here. Yeah, there's nowhere in here where it says whether or not it actually types stuff.
Okay, you know how I want to make like a little Twitter thing that'll just print it like a Twitter thing?
Oh, this, right, like a little Twitter stop.
This would be way better.
Yeah.
Hashtag awesome stop.
Yeah, I love this. I love the look of it. This just looks like something you might see on in a movie.
It looks loud, is what it looks like. I suspect
it is.
This thing shakes the floor.
You can find YouTubes
awesome.
Of these, and they are loud.
I like the YouTubes.
But they are cool.
Ken, have you heard of YouTube?
No, what's that?
Not familiar with it. I think you'd like it.
Really?
It is the time sink into which your entire life gets sucked if you're not careful. Mm-hmm.
Because of Ken.
That's right.
It's me.
Partially.
I am YouTube.
Sometimes I think you are.
He invented YouTube.
Awesome.
So that's my auction.
Nice.
And the price seems about commensurate for something of this age and something that actually still powers on and at least ostensibly does something. And there's even a make offer if you don't like the $777 U.S. price
tag. And why add 11 cents instead of 77 cents?
I don't know.
If you pick a theme and stick with it. I would do the make an offer, and I would offer him 66 cents more. Just to like, come on.
That's hilarious. All right, so that's mine. Are we out of auctions? I think we're out of auctions.
Yep.
I think we're into closing discussions. This is the part of the podcast where we say more stuff. So, Carrington, why don't you start?
Well, in the notes, I just say Kansas Fest was Kansas Fab. And I don't know if we've actually mentioned Kansas Fest enough on this episode, but
it's that get-together, right?
Rather I've than talking about that, I'm going to go back up to an item that I tweeted about like 2 weeks ago saying, well, I've already found the thing that is going to be my first news choice for this show, and I grabbed it and I stuck it in the show notes to claim it, and then it got bounced and I didn't actually talk about it, so now I want to talk about it because it's a great site. It's historyoficons.com. Not worth making a news article about, but I do want to make sure we have a link in the show notes because it's amazing. So it's this really well-designed site. It's beautiful and gorgeous, and it just talks about the history of icons like on a computer. So not like religious iconography, but just, you know, here's a little thing you can click on, and it's written sort of for an audience that might not be aware that computers didn't always look like this. So it's like, did you know that computers didn't always have a graphical interface? It's like, oh, I did not know that. Show me more. But it's beautiful. It's just a lovely design, and it goes through the history of stuff. So if you're interested in the early days of GUIs, then it's definitely a site to check out. So I claimed it, and now I've talked about it, so I don't feel guilty anymore.
Very cool. And you'll put the link up in the show notes.
It's already in there, and I see that Paul has magically made it mine. Thank you, Paul.
Yes.
Awesome. So, Ken, you're up.
Europe. What about Asia? Antarctica? Don't they get any love?
They only had like two good songs.
I would love to go to Antarctica, but it's too expensive.
We would love for you to go to Antarctica.
Really?
Yeah.
Would you love it enough to pay my way?
No,
I didn't
think
so.
I just want to say that by the time we record the next episode of RCR, I will have a new product to announce.
Ooh.
Oh.
Is it a scent?
Well, I'm working on two
fabulous
products.
Fabulous.
You left him speechless for a second.
I'm actually working on two products. One will definitely be out. If I can get the other one done, you can get two for the price of one. But we'll see.
All right.
We'll see.
All right. Well, we're going to hold you to that.
I wanted to be a scent.
I could see the commercials now.
Retro, by Kanye.
Oh, man. I'm going to need some mind bleach. All right. Paul.
So any hints, though? You're just going to drop the product bomb and not even give us a hint at all? Nothing?
Nope, nothing.
Beard trimmer.
Man.
Yes. No.
Excellent.
Yep. For those who need the chin full of win.
All
right. Hey, Paul, you got to save us from ourselves.
Right. Well, let's see. Yeah. So let's see. As I say, I just kind of landed from Kansas Fest and still kind of trying to unearth myself from the piles of stuff that got left undone. At Kansas Fest, I got a weird little mouse. At Kansas Fest, there's this garage giveaway where a lot of the stuff comes from Sean Fahey's garage, but sort of put out there and people sort of pounce on it when the moment is right. Actually, a couple people mm-hmm. pounced a little before the moment was right, but at any rate, and I was sort of stood by this mouse, and as soon as the clock went, I grabbed it. But it's a joystick. Of some sort, but it looks like a mouse. It has three buttons and this little white thing, and it plugs into the normal joystick port on an Apple II. And I'm sort of curious to see what happens with that, so I want to play with that. What else I have to build? The PyDP. I've played a little bit with the disk imaging project. Got a little bit further at Kansas Fest, but didn't have any time to actually really work on it. So I've just yesterday completed an experiment where I have written a bunch of zeros to a disk, and then I've tried to read it back with the card that I have, and found that when I read it back, there are a lot of ones in that bunch of things that I knew were zeros when I wrote them. So that's sort of interesting to see. I knew it was going to happen, but it was interesting to see just how many ones there were. So that's about it. I don't know. I have lots to do.
All right. Well, everybody's busy. I'm busy too. After getting that fourth hacked to where it worked on the Commodore 128, and it was a little bit of an ugly hack, now I want to unhack it and actually start to make some nice source code out of it and go further down the line with that. Maybe give it some Commodore 128 specific features. And I'm actually going to change what assembler that it uses, because there's another one that I like better. And all the youngins out there talking about JavaScript and Node.js and stuff like that, what do they know? Who needs all that stuff when you have Forth? I mean, really, right? Who's with me?
I'm with you on JavaScript.
it's interesting that, don't get me started on that rant. Now, it's weird how such a not pretty language has really become the lingua franca of the internet, but that's a conversation for another day, and it's not retro.
Not pretty is a remarkably polite way to put that.
Yes, I'm being diplomatic here.
Although we can play a lot of things in our browsers now.
We can. That's true. That's one of the neat things. But you notice even that uses a tool to compile a higher level language into JavaScript rather than working with JavaScript on its own.
Besides, the web is a fad.
Right. Yeah, it's going away. Yeah. But I don't know what's going to replace it. I think that whole...
Gopher is making a comeback big in 2016. You heard it here first.
University of Minnesota again.
Yep. CompuServe's turning the lights back on. All right. Well, that's it for this show. The podcast is still free because those discussions with Marvel about the franchise Superheroes of Retro fell through. So that's not going to happen. I'd had the cape tailored and everything.
I thought you meant free like on the lamb. Okay, yes, cool.
That's right.
I can get behind this.
free as in beer, free as in freedom. You can find the show notes for all the RCR shows at rcrpodcast.com, strangely. You can discuss us in the forums, or you can be disgusted with us at vintage-computer.com/VC forum. Not many posts lately. I got to get rowdy over there and start some trouble. You can follow RCR on Twitter at RCR Podcast, and with Ken at the helm, thankfully we actually have tweets these days. Somebody's actually at the wheel doing things, which is cool. You can send feedback to feedback@rcrpodcast.com. And we got lots of feedback. In fact, there's a couple of news stories that we had to hold over for another episode because people were sending us such wonderful stuff. So thank you for that. We are a proud member of the Throwback Network, run by the infamous Mr. Jack Flack over at throwbacknetwork.net. If you want to review us, you can write up a review on iTunes. We'd love to see it. And until next time,
Retro Compuse!
Retro by Kanye.